Good morning. I think it's 3085 is the one.
This is the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Civil Law, Monday, March 28, 2005, at 8:30 a.m. in room 357.
The House Judiciary Subcommittee on Civil Law is now in session, and we're open for business. There's going to be a couple of changes in the order of the bills we'll hear today to accommodate some state representatives who will be testifying. We're going to do the bills in the following order. House Bill 3085 will go first. House Bill 2524 next, then 2983, then 2545, then 3078. So we'll call, let's see, on House Bill 3085, I have six folks signed up. I have all of those in favor. I'll take Representative Richardson's testimony first.
Chair Eckman, members of the subcommittee. I'm Dennis Richardson, state representative for District 4 in Southern Oregon, and I'm here as the chief sponsor for House Bill 3085. And the reason this bill is brought before this committee is the is to rectify wrongs that have taken place in recent decades, and especially in recent years, of overreaching by certain state agencies. I have with me, and you'll hear today, from a constituent, Bob Caravan, who was arrested. He's a farmer in Southern Oregon and was arrested as a result of taking and messing with gravel on a stream bed in his property to use for his farm roads. He and other farmers were told by an agency that they had to either cop a plea to the actions being taken against them by the state, or else they were told that they would be made a felon if they didn't. They were told, I'll make a felon out of you. In addition, there has been a couple of court cases recently where citizens have been repeatedly sued or taken through administrative processes by state agencies, have lost. The state agencies will appeal and then lose on appeal, and then continue to take actions detrimental to the citizens, and they do it with impunity, with an understanding that the courts in Oregon have taken certain statutes that we have and have essentially changed the wording relating to costs and attorney's fees to make it almost a frivolous lawsuit kind of standard, which means essentially that the state agencies can do whatever they want without having any responsibility to restore or to cover the costs of the citizen. And so there's this ongoing threat of bankrupting the citizen through procedural process after procedure, after hearing, after appeal. In fact, as you'll find out from Mr. Caravan's testimony, he has personally invested over $300,000 of his own money in multiple hearings and cases to protect himself and his cat driver, who was also arrested at the time that that the state agencies determined that he had not gotten a permit that they thought he should get. You also find out that as a farmer, he's exempted from having to actually get the permit that he was told that he had to get, or else, and cop a plea to, or else he was going to be charged as a felon. This bill deals with two sets of statutes that the courts have used. I'd like to share with you just the wording on out of one. And so I'm turning to ORS 183.497. This deals with attorney's fees, and it has two provisions. Subparagraph A says, that a court may, in its discretion, allow a petitioner reasonable attorney's fees and costs if the court finds in favor of the petitioner. So it's a discretionary thing in any case. But subsection B says, the court shall allow a petitioner reasonable attorney's fees and costs if the court finds in favor of the petitioner and determines that the state agency acted without a reasonable basis in fact or in law. And that it's not discretionary. It's, you know, it's a mandatory application unless there is the agency acted with substantial reason. The courts in a recent holding, it's called the Cabe case, K-A-I-B, they read that statute and then turned to Oregon, or ORS 20.075, and I'll read just one section of that. The introductory paragraph on 20.075 says, a court shall consider the following factors in determining whether to award attorney's fees in any case in which an award of attorney's fees is, first, authorized by statute, and in which, second, the court has discretion to decide whether or not attorney's fees should be awarded. So what we have is the courts have taken this wording and they've looked back at the first statute and they said, well, that's discretionary, even though it says you shall do them, you shall award them. And so they've reinterpreted the shall to mean may. And so in that instance, with that kind of reinterpretation, it is almost an impossible standard for a common citizen to overcome. In fact, in earlier this month, there was a case called the Powell case, which was involving the Boy Scouts and the school district. The school district up in Portland wasn't going to let the Boy Scouts be able to meet there. There was a hearing on the lower court level, and the Boy Scouts won. It was then appealed, and the Boy Scouts won again. But the court, using the same reasoning that had been used in the Cabe case, said that there'd be no attorney's fees paid back to the Boy Scouts, even though they had won at every step. So basically what this bill, and I need to mention something else, and that is that this is not a new problem. The federal government in the 70s saw this as a big issue, and so they passed the Federal Equal Access to Judgment Act. And then in 1979, this was discussed in Oregon. And then in 1981, it was actually, a statute was passed, the one that I read to you, that made it a shall or a mandatory application, an objective standard, not just a subjective kind of standard. And in 1981, when we passed the law, it placed into Oregon statutes essentially what had been placed in the Federal Equal Access to Justice Act. But the courts have reinterpreted that out so that it's almost impossible for common citizens to be able to have the threat of bankruptcy taken away from them. You have people that cannot stand up for their own rights because they're afraid that they can't afford to fight the battle. So we've come to this subcommittee with House Bill 3085. It merely is to reinstate what was the law since 1981, but in a way that the courts can't wiggle out of. We've had too much judicial interpretation and judicial legislation. We see it on a federal level, and we see it on a state level, and it's time for the legislature to tell the judiciary specifically that they cannot allow state agencies to trample on the rights of individual citizens merely because the state agencies have more money and because the state agencies can threaten the individual citizen with bankruptcy or with making them a felon merely because individuals do not have the power, the financial resources to fight the state agencies. We know many state agencies, you know, most are fine, upstanding citizens that are trying to do a good job, but in those rare instances where we have renegade or self-serving individuals that use the state's power in a way to harm common Oregonian citizens, that must stop. And so House Bill 3085 is to merely make sure that the agencies understand that if they do not have a substantial, reasonable reason to prosecute an individual citizen, then they're going to end up having to bear the cost that the citizen has to defend himself. Any questions?
Thank you, Representative. Questions from the committee? Representative McPherson?
Mr. Chair. Representative Richardson, you cited a statute that that is not, I think, amended by this bill, and I didn't catch the citation on that.
The second one?
Yeah.
The second one was 20.075, which is a statute that talks about what the various levels of or considerations court should use in a discretionary application for or awarding of attorney's fees. And so they basically say if it's not reckless and willful, malicious, you know, that these are factors that a court should use when they have the discretionary right to award attorney's fees. But what we're saying is that the law in 1981 inserted provisions that say that in an instance such as we're discussing here, it is a mandatory requirement that attorney's fees and costs and disbursements be awarded.
Could you give me that statutory citation again?
Yes. The citation I'm referring to is ORS 483.497.1B.
I'm still confused.
Okay.
Okay, too many numbers.
All right. There's two statutes that we're dealing with, one that was passed in 1981, and that is ORS 183.497.1B, and that is the statute that says that it'll be a mandatory.
I'm sorry.
You know, it's a mandatory application unless the agency can show, you know, a substantial reason for prosecuting against the individual citizen. It says that the state agency must have acted without a reasonable basis in law or fact. Or so the attorney's fees would be awarded unless there's that reasonable basis. The other statute is 20.075, which is general information for courts on the awarding of discretionary attorney's fees.
Thank you. Further questions?
Sam, last one.
Yes, counsel.
Representative Richardson, I just wanted to raise a question. I look at the original language from the statute you mentioned, which is found in Section 2 of the bill that's being deleted, and you say that the Court of Appeals is found that gives the court's discretion, even though it uses the shall wording. That's, mm-hmm. Is that correct? And I assume that discretion is because it goes on to say, but the court may withhold all or part of the attorney's fees, and it goes on. And then I see in the amended statute there's also mandatory language. However, I see this is in subsection 3 of section 2 of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
There's the term unless the court finds the state agency has proved that the state agency's action was substantially justified. To me, it seems that this language is going to, that the Court of Appeals may come to the same conclusion. I haven't read the cases you're referring to yet, but under the amended bill, doesn't it leave us in the same place that we would be as the original statute?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Sears, would it be acceptable to the panel if I invited to join us Clarence Greenwood, who's an attorney in Portland who has been thoroughly involved in these cases and has greater background knowledge and would be able
that's
to
respond? That's fine. Have him come forward, please.
Okay.
Could you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Clarence Greenwood. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Black Helterline.
My name is Natalia Yegorova. I'm a researcher with Black Helterline, and I'm a law student at Lewis and Clark Law School.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Mr. Sears, my understanding of the question is that you're wondering whether or not the changes of the wording in the statute are really going to bring about the desired effect. And while the wording you specifically referred to might leave some confusion only because the courts have somehow taken shall and have redefined it as being may or you know, in a way that's much less restrictive. If you go to the very beginning of the bill under subsection 1, D, where it talks about, you know, substantially justified shall mean to a degree that could satisfy a reasonable person, and then on section 1, subparagraph 2, about starting in the middle of line 3, it says, persons must not be deterred in seeking judicial review of or defending against unreasonable state agency actions because of the expense involved in vindicating their rights. It is the legislative assembly's intent to deter state agencies' wrongdoing and provide compensation to parties injured by state agencies that are not substantially justified. And so what we're trying to do is spell out in the statute what was clear in the legislative intent back in the 1981 hearings. But the legislative intent has not been given any heed by the appellate courts, and so we wanted to put into the statute itself the specific reasons why we're using the terms that we're using.
All right, let's have the other two witnesses testify, please.
In addition, you will find that House Bill 3085 deletes the discretionary standard that previously appeared in Section 183.497. That's deliberately done because if you read the Cabes roving case, the Court of Appeals basically held that there's no difference between 183.497 1A and 1B. Our intent in getting rid of A in this bill is to make clear to them there is no discretionary standard any longer in dealing with state agencies. It'll be just like federal law. There's one standard, substantially justified.
Thank you. And does Richard testify?
I think Clarence addressed any issues that
they may. I have about four concerns or questions, and I'd like to just take them in this order. The process for seeking a fee award requires you to file a petition within 30 days. Is the petitioner the person seeking attorney's fees? I don't see that there's any chance that the state can file a rebuttal or response. Is that correct? The way the bill is drafted?
State has the opportunity to respond. And if they can show that they have...
No, show me in the statute, sir. If I'm missing that, that's okay. But we have 30 days to file the petition seeking fees.
Section 2, item 3, line 4.
Well, just give me the page and line number. That's easier for me.
Page 3, line 3.
Line 3?
Line 4. Line 4. It contemplates that unless the court finds the state agency has proved that the state agency's action was substantially justified. And that's the same language that's in current law that the 1981 legislature placed there to allow a state agency to file and show that it in fact did have a sound basis in law or fact for its enforcement position.
I guess then let me just state my point. As I see line 15 on page 3 as an example, 30 days after judgment, petitioner seeking award of fees files a petition. And then you have a lot of subpoints as to what the petition should contain. I don't see a a timeline for the state to file a response to the attorney fee petition, A, and B, of course, since you don't show it there, it doesn't have a timeline within which they should respond. So I'm worried. If you don't intend to limit the right of the agency to respond, that's one thing. If you do, that's another. But the way I see it, you file your petition, and the court makes a decision. There's no chance for the state to rebut the petition.
Then the normal rules of civil procedure would kick in on all court procedures once the petition is filed, and they can file a response. And the court, if it needs more information, can order whatever necessary further filings it feels necessary before making its finding.
My preference, sir, is that you state a timeline for the state to file a rebuttal or a response to the petition for attorney's fees so it's clear. I don't like this idea that something else is going to kick in. We don't refer to
Mr. Chair, we would be happy to amend it so that after the petition is filed that the normal rules of civil procedure and timelines contained therein would apply.
Okay. My second question is why do you circumvent the processes of ORCP 68, which is a standardized form under the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure for the filing of attorney fee petitions and hearings thereon. Is there any reason why you didn't have ORCP 68 pick up this process? That requires a petition, a statement of fees, to be filed within, I think, 14 days of the judgment, and there's a 14-day rebuttal for the other side. Any reason why we're not going there?
We've done that, again, for the same reason that we took away the discretionary standard in order to avoid confusion between civil litigation, between private parties, and agency litigation. And all we're doing here is really codifying the Adams case of the Court of Appeals that already has made that distinction.
Okay. I just think it creates a policy question for the committee as to whether... I look at ORCP 68 as the common vehicle for the adjudication of attorney fee requests. If you're going to go beyond that, in which I think you have, then I do think we need more discussion. My third point is you include within costs that would be recoverable in this petition, not only attorney's fees, but expert witness fees. Am I correct?
That is left up to the court as to what's reasonable, given the nature of the fight.
Okay. And you can think of any other situation where expert witness fees are a cost of recovery under the procedural code of the state of Oregon?
I'd have to research that, but I do believe you can recover your costs, and there's a provision in a contract or by statute, costs include expert costs, because many of these things that you have to deal with, you need expert witnesses.
All right.
Mr. Chair,
my fourth point is that looking for reference on page 2, line 12, you are not under ORCP 68, costs are statutorily defined. Am I correct that you are going beyond the normal definition of costs provided in ORCP 68 when you state the court shall award the petitioner all costs and disbursement the court finds were necessary for the preparation of the petitioner's case?
Mr. Chair, the answer is yes, and that was intentional. Normally in a civil litigation, you have two parties that are merely using the power of the government and the law as a forum to resolve differences. In this instance, we have the government itself with essentially unlimited power and unlimited funds to prosecute cases against the common citizen. And so you can, even with normal ORCP 68 provisions, you could break the common citizen just because they can't afford to hire the expert witnesses that are needed to counteract the unlimited amount of funds that can be expended by the government for their experts. Mm-hmm. And so the goal is to help private citizens be able to be vindicated and not be bankrupt in the process.
Okay, thank you. And I just want to know the reasons why there is a departure from existing procedural law under ORCP 68. Other questions? Representative McPherson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question could go to either Mr. Greenwood or Representative Richardson. I'm trying to get a sense about the extent to which this is really changing the law from what exists in statute currently. I look at ORS 183.497.1b, the existing language, which includes the shall language, that is, the court shall allow reasonable attorney's fees if the court finds in favor of the petitioner, and that the state agency acted without a reasonable basis in fact or in law. And then there's a proviso, but the court may withhold attorney's fees if the agency has proved that its action was substantially justified. And the new language requires payment unless the agency has proved that the action was substantially justified, and the standard there is the state agency, I guess the burden of proof is on the state agency to prove that the action had a reasonable basis in fact or in law. Help me out a little bit. In what way are we changing the substantive law here?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I'll take the first crack at it. You're absolutely correct. What we're trying to do is shift the burden of proof to the government to show that they had a reasonable basis to bring about the action that they chose. Otherwise, the burden is on the citizen. Essentially, what we have today, it's on the citizen's back to show that this wasn't a frivolous action, which is almost an impossible standard. And so this is to not only reiterate what was statutorily written, but to do it in a way that will cause the appellate courts to understand that their reinterpretation was incorrect, and then also to put the burden on the government to show that they had a substantial reason for bringing the actions that they've done.
The main legal
change. Go ahead, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Yeah, please.
The main legal change is, again, clarifying that there's only one standard. It's the mandatory standard. The discretionary standard is gone. And you have to read the Cabe's decision, where the Court of Appeals, despite the distinctly different language in 1A and 1B, said there's no difference in those two standards. That's what they held in Cabe's case. Then they jumped from that conclusion to 20075, which never was intended to apply to state agency action. And if you go read 20075, you'll find there's a state of mind criteria as one of the things you're supposed to consider. Now, you go back to 1981, the legislature was very clear in adopting 1B. They did not want a state of mind standard. They wanted a reasonable person standard based on federal law. And that was the concept they were adopting. All we're doing here is clarifying that the federal standard of substantial justification is the standard that agency action will be judged by in Oregon. The idea that you cannot obtain a reward of costs unless you can prove an evil intent, mental state on the part of the state agency is being erased. Because our position is the same as expressed in the 79 legislative history and the 81 legislative history. If a citizen has to prove the agency had an evil intent, there will be no award of fees. I believe David Frohmeyer's testimony in 79 is the clearest on that, but also Representative Smith's testimony in the 81 legislative hearings is also very clear on that.
Thank you. Representative Flores, I don't know if you're raising your hand or you can give me your look that you have a question.
Well, probably both.
Both, okay. I thought you were reading it right today.
As I have noted, and just for clarification, and I think probably to reiterate what you just said, Mr. Greenwood, that Section 2, Paren 1A, A is the discretionary language which would be deleted by this law, and it would, as it currently appears, and that you want to put in the conform to no discretion allowed and conform this to federal law with one standard which indicates substantially justified means. So there is no conflict.
Existing statute currently. I look at requires payment unless the agency has proved that the action was substantially justified, and the standard there is the state agency, I guess the burden of proof is on the state agency to prove that the action had a reasonable basis in fact or in law. What, help me out a little bit. In what way are we changing the substantive law here?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I'll take the first crack at it. You're absolutely correct. What we're trying to do is shift the burden of proof to the government to show that they had a reasonable basis to bring about the action that they chose. Otherwise, the burden is on the citizen. Essentially, what we have today, it's on the citizen's back to show that this wasn't a frivolous action, which is almost an impossible standard. And so this is to not only reiterate what was statutorily written, but to do it in a way that will cause the appellate courts to understand that their reinterpretation was incorrect, and then also to put the burden on the government to show that they had a substantial reason for bringing the actions that they have done.
The main legal change is again clarifying that there's only one standard. It's the mandatory standard. The discretionary standard is gone. And you have to read the Cabe's decision where the Court of Appeals, despite the distinctly different language in 1A and 1B, said there's no difference in those two standards. That's what they held in Cabe's case. Then they jumped from that conclusion to 20075, which never was intended to apply to state agency action. And if you go read 20075, you'll find there's a state of mind criteria as one of the things you're supposed to consider. Now you go back to 1981, the legislature was very clear in adopting 1B. They did not want a state of mind standard. They wanted a reasonable person standard based on federal law. And that was the concept they were adopting. All we're doing here is clarifying that the federal standard of substantial Justification is the standard that agency action will be judged by in Oregon. The idea that you cannot obtain a reward of costs unless you can prove an evil intent, mental state, on the part of the state agency is being erased. Because our position is the same as expressed in the 79 legislative history and the 81 legislative history. If a citizen has to prove the agency had an evil intent, there will be no award of fees. I believe David Frohmeyer's testimony in 79 is the clearest on that, but also Representative Smith's testimony in the 81 legislative hearings is also very clear on that.
Thank you. Representative Flores, I don't know if you're raising your hand or giving me your look that you have a question.
Well, probably both.
Both, okay. I thought you were reading right today.
As I have noted, and just for clarification, and I think probably to reiterate what you just said, Mr. Greenwood, that Section 2, Paren 1A, A is the discretionary language which would be deleted by this law, and it would, as it currently appears, and that you want to put in the conform to no discretion allowed and conform this to federal law with one standard which indicates substantially justified means. So there is no conflict. You're eliminating the discretionary language and binding it together into one standard. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I believe the discretionary standard, if you read the 85 legislative history, was left there sort of a afterthought. But it's clearly caused confusion in the court's mind, because if you read the Cabes case again, they say the language in A is the same as in B, and I don't read it that way. And that's the confusion that they're having is due to that discretionary standard being left in 85. That's why we're proposing to take it up. We just have one standard then.
Yes,
Mr.
Chair.
Then was there a difficulty in court interpretation up to the 1983 decision in CABE? Has there been conflicting decision making, or was this kind of the most egregious pinnacle?
I didn't follow the first part of your question, if you could reiterate.
Has there been significant interpretation using or conflicting with the discretionary, non-discretionary language up until the CABE decision in 2003?
Well, strangely, right after the mandatory provision was originally adopted, the Court of Appeals paid attention. It ruled in the Van Gordon case and set down a set of rules that they said they were going to follow. And if you look at those rules, there was hope for citizens. That was, I believe, a 1983 decision. But then you look at it, and my researcher here has done way more looking at it than I. If you look at brother-sister states, i.e. Minnesota, Washington, Idaho, California, who will have the same standard as the mandatory standard, the number of citizens who win there are about 40-45%. In Oregon, since 81, only about 19%, I believe, have ever been awarded any fees. However, you go back to the Cabes case in 2003, the Court of Appeals recognized its prior decision in Van Gordon, but didn't follow it. And in the Powell case that the representative mentioned, again, they don't mention the fact that that the Van Gordon case is out there, but they held very clearly in Powell, you can ignore the statute and you don't have to you won't get fees, or you can misconstrue the statute and you still do not get awarded fees. I don't know what's left that you can win as a citizen on if the agency can ignore the statute or misconstrue it and both times walk out of the room without having to pay.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Okay, hearing none, then you're excused, and we'll take the next panel. John Chandler? Rick Angston?
Good morning. My name's Rick Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 3085. The big view here is that the agencies are not always right, and the cost to prove that should not always be borne by the defendant. And I think that's the basic gist of the bill. From my view, reading the language, is how they define substantially justified, which under the old language was kind of the exception, and under this one, under this particular bill, it's fleshed out a little bit more. And I think that's an appropriate discussion to be had to tighten down what is substantially justified, so when the state agencies aren't right, that the costs are not borne by the defendant. I have plenty of examples. I think most of us in the private sector would have plenty of examples, and I'm not going to go through them. You've got a list of folks here that are going to come in and testify to that effect. And I'm here to answer questions if you have some on the language itself. But I think one thing that's, as I was looking at the language, I think there is some work that still needs to be done. And I think some of that was pointed out, and one other additional one that I think also needs some look at. And under the definition of substantially justified, you basically have a definition of substantially justified in the bill. And then when you get down in Section 3 on the first page as an example, line 28, the state agency's action is substantially justified if the state agency can prove that the action has a reasonable basis in fact or law. Those two need to be merged into one definition because I think that's part of the confusion the way I read it. I do understand that it also shows shifts the burden to the state or leaves it with the state agency. I'm not sure how that initially worked, but it does. You essentially have two definitions, and they need to be combined. And I think that would clear up a lot of the discussion that's going on. With that, I conclude my testimony, and I will open for questions.
Fine, thank you. I think we'll take on Mr. Chandler first and then open the questions up for both of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of House Bill 3085. I don't have a lot to add to the previous testimony other than to encourage the committee to first focus on the policy issues behind this bill, which are to make the playing field a little more level between state agencies and those subject to state agency enforcement actions. As Mr. Angstrom pointed out, state agencies aren't always right. They aren't always wrong. But the burden of going forward, if you're the private property owner, the private business person, when you're faced with the need for experts and all the panoply of facts that you have to bring forward, if there's no way to get that cost back, if there's no break on the state agency's enforcement action in forms of cost and attorney's fees, as you all know from other areas of law, that can be prohibitive. And we've done this, we've used statutes such as this, as what this bill is trying to form up, which a lot of us thought we'd fixed many years ago. We've used this process. We haven't presupposed any particular outcome. We've simply said, if you lose and you didn't have a good argument for why you lost, other than just being a pain, you get to pay the other side's fees. In other areas of civil law, that works very well to constrain what I might consider frivolous position taking. I think it's time that standard was beefed up and applied back to state agencies. I think the statute was fairly clear. I think the court in the Caves case and others flat misinterpreted it or misconstrued it or just ignored it, whatever action whatever you want to use. I think this bill, with some necessary, I think some tinkering that has already been pointed out, will go a long way towards restoring that balance. I think it's important from an economic development standpoint, it's important from a fairness standpoint, that a private business person being enforced against has the ability to fight back and get their costs recovered and their attorney's fees recovered should they be successful. As with Mr. Angstrom, I could bring in lists of war stories as well. I'd be more than happy to do that sometime. It's fairly entertaining. If you ever have a night meeting, where adult beverages would be involved, that'd be even more entertaining. But I won't do that at this point, Mr. Chairman, unless you twist my arm. With that, I'll conclude my testimony. I should say I'd be more than happy to work with the Chair, Representative McPherson, committee staff, or Representative Richardson in working on some amendment language. In the previous testimony, it was indicated, I think it became pretty clear there's some tweaking to the language in front of you that would be necessary to make the bill work better. I'd be more than happy to help there if at all possible. Thank
Fine.
You.
Appreciate that. Questions of the witnesses from the committee? Hearing none, then you're excused. Thank you. I have a Bob Caravan, and it looks like Bud is a reader. I'm having a hard time reading your writing, but I'm always susceptible to being corrected. I'd like to come forward and state your names for the record, please. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Atkinson, Representative Atkinson, and the committee members, my name is Bob Caravan, and I'm a grape farmer from Josephine County, Cave Junction area. If there ever was a bill that is needed, this is the one. The working people and the entrepreneurs of Oregon need this judicial equality. Even when wrongfully charged, the average person just cannot afford to get into a legal confrontation with the state agencies and is forced to either plea bargain or admit guilt, whether they're guilty or not. Those with deep pockets who take the plunge to fight for their rights usually find themselves tied up for years in one court after another, until attorney fees eventually cause them to capitulate. This has become a win-win situation for the agencies and a lose-lose situation for, and in my case, the school funds. Because the agencies spend all kinds of money. They don't take it out of the school funds. I'm talking about the DSL. They just don't put it in the school funds. I feel that there's been $1.5 million wasted on my case alone. And it's almost disgraceful. In reading the history of OSR 183-497, the 1981 legislature mandated that prevailing party shall receive costs and attorney's fees. However, a conflicting law states that in order to determine if fees are awarded, you have to prove that the agency was reckless, willful, malicious, in bad faith, or illegal. Just how does one do that? Passage of House Bill 3085 would rectify these wrongs and place a burden of proof on the accuser. Respectfully yours, thank you. Your time.
Fine, I appreciate your testimony. I know you've come from a long way. Let's hear from the other witness, and then we'll see if we have questions.
Members of the committee, Chair, my name is Bud Ginger. I'm a dairy farmer from Tillamook, Oregon. I bought my first farm in 1957 and farmed there ever since. Our farm includes the Delta on the Tillamook Bay, all the way from the Kilchis to the Tillamook River. And we've increased the production on that farm from several times. And it's a big farm, and it's a very economical unit now. And through the years, I've diked lands and ditched and drained and improved it, and something I'm really proud of. This is an example I'm giving of the DSL and the problems I have. I have a suit against them too, but never had a problem until in the 95-96, and then I had a farm. My farm extended out to the 101, and different folks coming down the road have turned me in to DSL. And this last case, the DSL sent a representative out to my excavator where I was working and cleaning, and gave me a stop order. And I asked him why, and I told him, was he aware of the farm exemptions that are there, that we can clean our ditches and our tile and our and to maintain normal farming practice on a converted wetlands, and which 90% of my farm is converted wetlands. And he wasn't even aware of the exemption. And the stop work order stopped me from farming, and it's caused me a lot of problems. Taking a lot of time and a lot of headaches, and I just believe when the state agency or any agency does that to an individual, they've been bullies. They haven't listened to just cause, and I believe when they do that and they delay it, that they should be responsible for refurbishing the costs to the private individual. I think our country is made up of entrepreneurs and people that get out and do their own thing, and I don't think they should be discriminated against. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ginger, the stop work order, how many days did that put you out of production?
Oh, probably 6 months.
Wow.
And it still hasn't been resolved, and this has been almost a year. But they did tell me that I could go ahead and finish it after about 6 months.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee?
Following up, if I could, having grown up in a dairy farm, when you say out of production, you mean out of the cows weren't being milked?
No, sir, I'm sorry.
Okay.
The project took that portion of my farm.
I see.
It was out of production, the grass, and we make silage, et cetera.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The cows are safe.
Okay.
Thank you for your testimony, then. We have two more witnesses, Julie Brandes and Tim Bernasek. Would you like to come forward? You keep your comments brief. We spent a lot of time on this. It's apparent it's going to go back for some amendments, but you bring up some new issues. We'd appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Julie Brandes here today representing Associated Oregon Industries. Lisa Tressel had intent to testify on this legislation today. She is in a workers' comp hearing downstairs in Hearing Room D, as is J.L. Wilson. Mr. Wilson asked me to inform the committee that he is also supportive of this legislation. AOI doesn't have much to add to the testimony that you have heard today, so I will not read what Lisa had typed out, just to make sure it's on the record that we do support this legislation and attempts to amend it and move it forward.
Fine. Thank you very much. Next.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tim Bernasek, General Counsel of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I, too, have submitted a couple pages of my analysis of the situation. I won't go into that. It very much mirrors what you've heard from other folks this morning. I guess I would add, in my years in private practice, this is a real issue. I've represented a lot of farmers, a lot of landowners, small business owners, and the unfortunate reality when you get into litigation for business owners is it's a cost to go forward and it's a cost to get out of it. And the question that I feel ethically obligated to tell my clients is, you know, how do we get you out of this situation with the least cost so you can get back to running your operation, doing your business, or whatever you need to do? And oftentimes the cost of hiring folks like me to represent them is a big hurdle in proceeding in these matters, particularly when it's almost impossible to get your attorney fees back if you're right and if the agency action is completely unwarranted. And you've heard situations this morning where that is applied, and I have had folks that I've represented that, in my opinion, have settled because just to get the nuisance off of their plate in a way so they can get back to their business. And I think that these amendments are important. I think it's a clarification of what the law was intended to be in the first place, and I think that it allows folks, private parties, when they're in this litigate or settle state of mind, options to say, well, you know, this really is absolutely frivolous, unmerited, and yeah, there's no guarantee I'm going to get my attorney fees back, but, you know, I'm right, It's the right thing to do to challenge this, and I'm willing to roll the dice if I've got a shot at proving my point and getting my costs and fees back. And that's the way our system should run. And so I really encourage you, if you need to tweak it, as you mentioned this morning, certainly we would have no problem with that. But I would urge you to please take this situation very seriously. It is a big issue for a lot of landowners, small business owners, and farmers in this state. And with that, thank you very much. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Fine. Thank you for your testimony. Any other questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Just a reminder, I can remember three people sitting here, the appeals court judge, past Supreme Court judge, spent an hour talking to us about legislative intent and drafting of bills. If you look at 183-497-1B, how more clear could have we been? Now we're going to have to go back and tell the court again. The fact is, in too many instances today, they are legislating from the bench, and they intentionally ignore legislative intent. I hope, Mr. Chair, that you do get some amendments, because this bill is going to come out of committee.
That would be my intent, and I do agree, Chair Krieger, and with the members that have testified about the Employment Division case. I do believe it was wrongly decided. I read it over the weekend several times, and I think there was a correction that's needed. The bill has some technical problems, and we'll proceed with that in just a moment. Any other questions or statements? Yes, counsel.
I just need to make a statement for the record. Two individuals submitted testimony, Mr. Gusmeyer from Tillamook, Oregon, and Mr. Ross Day for Oregonians in Action. That testimony has been made available to the committee members.
Further comments from the committee? If not, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3085. We'll not proceed to a work session on that bill. I will form a work group, and if people are interested in working with me on that, let my office know by, say, 2:30 this afternoon, or contact me otherwise. Try to keep the number down to about 3 to 5 more people, and you may confer among yourselves perhaps this morning and figure out who could assist us in that project, including committee members if they wish to participate. With that, I will open the public hearing on House Bill 2524. Counsel, can you explain the bill, please?
Chair, I commend members of the committee House Bill 2524 and the -1 amendments that have been provided to you make several changes in landlord-tenant law. The changes are negotiated by the General Landlord-Tenant Coalition, which consists of 13 landlords and tenant advocates. These are all compromise changes, and Mr. Van Leidenham is here to testify on those changes.
Thank you, counsel. We have two witnesses, Mr. Van Landingham and Sean Miller. Would you both like to come forward, please? The committee just received the amendments this morning, so you probably rest assured we have not read them. But a short summary would certainly then be in order for us. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Van Landingham. I work as a lawyer for Lane County Law and Advocacy Center. It's a legal aid-type program. I represent low-income tenants. I should start by saying that we will ask you not to move the bill today. I only got the -1s late Thursday and finished reading them yesterday, and there are a couple of errors in the -1 that will need to be corrected in a -2. Not a lot of them, but they're important to us. We negotiate in our coalition line by line, word by word. And these need to be fixed, and so we would hope that you would not take action today and allow you the time to read it if you wish, and us the time to make a -2 with corrections. But I can go through, let me just make a few prepared comments and then see if there are questions. As Sam Sears indicated, this is the product of a coalition. The coalition is 13 folks. It represents 7 different interest groups, 4 landlord groups, and 3 tenant groups, as well as a couple of free agents. Amendments to the Oregon Residential Landlord-Tenant Law have come to you in this fashion since the early 1980s, through a coalition, negotiated through a coalition of landlords and tenants. I've been the principal tenant negotiator and the principal drafter for the coalition since the 1993 session. Every 2 years, the interest groups get together with a wish list of issues that they would like fixed. We discuss those issues, those problems, why they're occurring, and see whether there are fixes that would work and that would be acceptable to everybody in the coalition. Most of this dash one amendment is simply cross-reference corrections. There are only seven substantive issues. I believe that Mr. Sears has given you my page and a half summary of those seven issues, and I can certainly review those seven issues or answer questions as you wish. Thank you.
Fine, thank you. I think we'll hear the testimony of Mr. Miller, and then we'll get into questions and procedures.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent the Oregon Rental Housing Association. My members, I have two individuals, Sharon Fleming Barrett, my legislative director, a landlord and property manager in Portland, and also Norton Cabell, a landlord in Eugene, who participate in the coalition. As Mr. Van Lanningham stated, it's a coalition that we meet in the interim. We negotiate for many months these changes. It's something that both sides get something out of the negotiations. I think it makes your life a lot easier in this process because we're not fighting these issues before the committee. As Mr. Van Lanningham stated, the few technical corrections I think can be fixed very quickly, and we can come back to the committee with a dash two amendment. But I think if you would like, Mr. Chair, we can go through the issues today, so at the next hearing or work session, it could be, passed a little bit easier. I would like to, Mr. Chair, publicly acknowledge Mr. Van Lanningham. He is our chief drafter of this language. He takes a lot of hours on his own time to draft not only the tenants' issues but the landlords' issues in the group. And so I know on behalf of my organization and the coalition, we thank him for all the work that he does.
Let me first ask if there's any comments or questions from the committee. If not, I think I'd like to defer the whole thing to one public hearing rather than to piecemeal it, if you could. I anticipate that we have one bill this afternoon or this morning that will take a little more time than usual.
Okay.
I want to thank both of you, though, for your work in forming coalitions and compromises. I can't think of anything more contentious than landlord-tenant disputes, and when you folks come before us with resolved issues, you made a substantial contribution to our work and the work of the citizens of the state. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Further testimony on House Bill 2524. Hearing none, I will conclude the public hearing on that bill. And I will open a public hearing in House Bill 2983. Council.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2983 lowers the age of persons whose special rates or services are permitted under the law that prohibits discrimination based on age by place of public accommodations from 55 to 50. Basically, this bill allows businesses to offer senior discounts and other special services to people who are 50 or older without violating any discrimination laws.
We have two witnesses in favor of the proposal. Ask Mr. Martinez and Mr. Bennett to come forward.
As Mr. Van Lanningham stated, the few technical corrections I think can be fixed very quickly, and we can come back to the committee with a dash two amendment. But I think if you would like, Mr. Chair, we can go through the issues today, so at the next hearing or work session it could be passed a little bit easier. I would like to, Mr. Chair, publicly acknowledge Mr. Van Lanningham. He is our chief drafter of this language. He takes a lot of hours on his own time to draft not only the tenants' issues but the landlords' issues in the group. And so I know on behalf of my organization and the coalition, we thank him for all the work that he does.
Let me first ask if there's any comments or questions from the committee. If not, I think I'd like to defer the whole thing to one public hearing rather than to piecemeal it, if you could. I anticipate that we have one bill this afternoon or this morning that will take a little more time than usual.
Okay.
I want to thank both of you, though, for your work in forming coalitions and compromises. I can't think of anything more contentious than land grab tenant disputes, and when you folks come before us with resolved issues, you made a substantial contribution to our work and the work of the citizens of the state. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Further testimony on House Bill 2524. Hearing none, I will conclude the public hearing on that bill. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2983. Counsel.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2983 lowers the age of persons whose special rates or services are permitted under the law that prohibits discrimination based on age by place of public accommodations from 55 to 50. Basically, this bill allows businesses to offer senior discounts and other special services to people who are 50 or older without violating any discrimination laws.
We have two witnesses in favor of the proposal. Ask Mr. Martinez and Mr. Bennett to come forward.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. Just a real brief background on this legislation. The Oregon Bankers Association has approximately 16 committees composed of bankers throughout the state that looks at everything from bank operations to trust issues to human resources, just right on down the line. They look at approximately 400 to 500 bills each session. During the course of a review of a piece of legislation last session, we noticed that there was language in statute that allowed you to give discounts and provide special services to folks 55 and above. Well, some of our banks at that point were offering programs to 50 and above. So several of them have discontinued those programs until we could get this change to the law. So basically all we're doing, as the chair pointed out on the way into the room today, is changing one number in the statute, a 5 to a 0, and making it 50. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I can assure you there are banks around the state that stand ready to go back and offer these programs to 50 and above with the passage of this bill.
Thank you. Mr. Bennett?
Thank you very much, Chairman Ackerman, members of the committee. For the record, Rick Bennett representing AARP Oregon. With 460,000 members statewide, of whom there are 50-plus in age, we support this legislation as well. I think Mr. Martinez has clearly identified the problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Comments from the committee? Guess you don't get any questions. All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Anyone else willing to hear today to testify on House Bill 2983? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on 2983 and open a work session on 2983. Motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2983 to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves that House Bill 2983 move to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I assume that those of us between 50 and 55 need not declare conflict.
That's right.
Oh, stop.
You're lowering the age for senior citizens, too. I noticed that. I'm beyond that point, I think. Further questions or discussions from the committee? Hearing none, call the roll, please.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 2983 is forwarded to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation with Representative Flores as the carrier. and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2983. House Bill 3078, Council.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 3078 requires the Department of Human Services to offer parents who do not qualify for appointed counsel arbitration services as an alternative to court hearings when the child is taken into protective custody, when the DHS places the child into substitute care, or first appearance before a juvenile court. It also directs the DHS to adopt rules establishing procedures for arbitration services.
Thank you. Representative Anderson. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Ackerman and members of the committee. Thank you for giving us a chance to hear this bill. For the record, I'm Representative Gordon Anderson, District 3 in beautiful Josephine County. I've come to realize that there are many instances where we can make justice for our constituents into a very difficult and almost an unbearable obstacle when they are faced with the extremely emotional possibility of having custody of their children taken away. We all fully agree that the state must take part in such proceedings when children are being abused psychologically, emotionally, physically, or even sexually. But there are many cases that seem to be just a matter of opinion and difference in parenting styles between the parents and the Department of Human Services. At that point, money can become a major problem in the case. Parents have limited resources, but the state has seemingly unlimited funds. I've followed four cases in my district, one of which you'll hear today, and heard about numerous others in other districts around Oregon, where parents ran out of money but were faced by high-priced attorneys from the Attorney General's office, county attorneys, and indigent defense attorneys who are hired by the state. In a case I followed very closely in Josephine County courts, the attorney costs for the state and county were over $50,000 for one case. While it doesn't seem directly to relate to court costs, I did, at that case, count 15 Department of Human Services personnel in court on that hearing, essentially taking the whole day off to sit in court. Time management in our departments must become more efficient than that. While the state seemed willing to continue unendingly in court, the parents ran out of funds quickly and had to defend themselves against expert legal counsel. That's an unfair fight. We must make it fair for families to protect themselves against large government agencies, or we will destroy confidence in government and our judicial system. House Bill 3078 asks that families be given a right to seek simple arbitration in their disputes with child welfare services to save money while getting a fair hearing. Considering the costs of court hearings and the savings created by removing some of these cases from expensive court trials, this will save the state great amounts of money and make it possible for families to be heard in a reasonable setting. Having gone through an arbitration hearing by the Portland Arbitration Service myself 2 years ago, I can personally vouch for the fairness, thoroughness, and cost-effectiveness of such procedures. Both sides saved literally thousands, tens of thousands of dollars in attorney and court costs. I'd like you now to hear from one of the families I spoke about who have paid dearly for their attempt to keep their children. Then I'd like to summarize with some thoughts about this bill. I'd like to introduce Catherine Schubert and David Schubert to testify. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Catherine Schubert. I'm here to help this bill get passed and tell you my story and my plight of my husband and myself. I'm an adoptive mother. I adopted two children from this state, which were in four different foster homes before we received them. We received them in August of 2001. And we had them for approximately almost 2 years. There were a lot of difficulties which the state said that they would help us with, but because of budget constraints, they could not give my son the help that he needed. He needed more psychotherapy. He was having difficult problems. They refused to give him anything except for play therapy at the time, which was not working. Because I was such an advocate of getting him help, we approached the state for more help. We were shunned, and they felt that our abilities of taking care of these children were not to their standards. So they removed the children from us with undue cause on May 16th of 2003. We've been in litigation since then. We still are. The children have been moved since then three times. They're now in their third foster home. They keep saying they want to go home, and visitation had stopped a year ago, February 2nd, due to the state feeling that every time the children visited with us, they said they wanted to come home to us, and the state felt that that was a negative emotional impact on them, so they stopped visitation. Due to all the litigation, we had to hire an attorney to try and rectify all this. And the costs were unbelievable. We've paid $40,000 in attorney fees. We got to the point where we lost our dream house when we moved up here to retire. We're forced to move into a smaller home, and then we took a second on that home to continue to pay for court fees. Then we came before the judge and asked if we could have representation because we were running out of funds. Because we still owned property, we were denied representation. We then had to go in front of the court, opposite the attorney general, and try and represent ourselves, which we, you know, have no idea how to represent myself against the attorney general. We did the best we could. We're still in litigation. The children are still in another home. We've sold most of our belongings, two of our vehicles, our boat, and we're about ready to sell the house that we're living in now. I can't tell you what an impact this has done for us. We miss our children very much. We just want them back. And we're willing to do anything, so if we have to sell this house as well, we'll do that. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you. We'll get to the questions in just a moment. You have a statement, sir, and state your name for us.
Just to reiterate what the bill actually states is the fact that there's times where there is nothing more than a conflict of interest. It's really a lot of cases that I've met with a lot of foster parents and stuff that have really come into a conflict of interest where it becomes not about the children but about the personalities involved. And then the children suffer. And that's where ours are now. They're the ones that are suffering badly for this. And the costs involved on both sides, for the state and for us, are astronomical because of a conflict of interest of personalities. And I think something really needs to be done to take that out of the courtroom and put it into an arbitration setting to where you can take the personality and take the high-priced attorneys out of it, to where you can come to some kind of agreement or have somebody sit in front and say, okay, it isn't just nothing more than a disagreement. It's nothing to do with child abuse or anything else. It's an agreement, disagreement between the two parties. And to resolve the matter without bankrupting everybody.
Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Questions?
Mr. Chair, may I follow just a small... would you like to ask questions of the issue?
Well, if you have a you want to continue your statement, you may. Otherwise, we'll take questions.
Thank you very much. I think, as you can see, this is not a drug family. These are folks that had a business in the very heart of Grants Pass. They've lost that business. They've lost most of their possessions in a fight to try and keep up with the state. There are several things that I'd like to see come out of this bill. When LC drafted the bill, they had a section 1.3 says information disclosed and findings made in arbitration under this section are not admissible in any legal proceeding. We will seek an amendment on that, because I see two ways that we could prosper the citizens of our state in doing something along this line. One is that it could be used as admissible in a legal proceeding and be taken right as the final decision, much as most of the arbitration or mediation cases go. But I'm sure you're going to hear some testimony that says that can't be done. It can't go into court. It will not be admissible. In which case, I've not been able to find any of the sections in our revised statutes that say, with both sides agreeing by written permission, most of this arbitration or mediation, I believe, can be used and be admissible in a court. In which case, the second of my two suggestions would be that if a court decision by a judge is required, then this could be used as fact-finding to speed the whole process up, to be able to get the witnesses by their testimony, either by personal report or by deposition, and simplify the whole case quickly, easily, and cost-effectively, and then take it to the judge for a final decision and determination. I'm not an attorney. I'm not practicing law, but it does appear to me that we need to simplify the process that we have here for some families, some that are running up against a roadblock monetarily and cannot afford the actual court representation, could afford the simplicity of arbitration, but cannot be considered for indigent defense either. So, as presently written, I'd like to see an amendment. We will bring that forward to you before any possible work session. And then one other suggestion that we will make, and that is that the arbitration services be offered by the department, but not necessarily conducted by the department or their arbitrator or a mediator. I think separation in a case like this, like the judicial system has, would be good, and therefore possibly use of major arbitration services like the Portland Arbitration Services or others around the state would be wise. We'll bring those amendments to you. But I urge you to consider this bill seriously. I have three other cases in my own district. I'm sure that there are others throughout the state hearing the same thing, that we cannot fight the expense that the state is able to put into this without being broken financially. So I urge you to consider this, and hopefully we'll be able to write some amendments that will be meet with the needs of our ORS.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Schubert, is it Schubert?
Yes,
thank you. As I understand, the trigger that sent this whole thing forward was that you had adopted the four children that you had in foster care.
Two children.
Okay, and one of them needed some care or services, and you needed more or additional help from the state, and that was the trigger that caused ultimately the conflict, which was the basis for the removing your children from your home?
Yes, Representative Forrest.
they felt there was a conflict of interest in the way we were parenting the children. They felt that we were not capable of parenting these special needy children. There were 10 people in this meeting that was called last minute. And when I tried to convince them that we are capable of learning anything, we will take parenting classes. Again, we went to one seminar. I've read books, videos. We have done everything possible, but my child, my son, was acting out in such a manner that it was jeopardizing other children at school. So I was telling them that he's been in therapy for a year, and the therapy wasn't working. Is there something else that we can do? They informed me, due to the state budget at the time, they could not allow any more funds. Had they given my son more therapy, they would have saved the state a tremendous amount of money. We have lost so much, and the state has paid dearly, and we're still in litigation. And they're still trying to find out and have another fresh look at this case, and therefore putting my children through a third psych evaluation, you know, which is costly to the state again. And looking for a third psych evaluation for us as well, when the first two were quite favorable, but they felt that wasn't enough.
Mr. Chair, could I follow that? Chair Ackerman and Representative Flores, the reason the children were taken from the home was essentially because after the psychological problems that both the boy and the girl have had, the boy seems to be coming out of it slowly. Young girl is still having quite a bit of acting out. Mrs. Schubert asked for respite care, I believe, three times or four times, which is a normal procedure. After the third one, in which she made the comment, "Boy, I think I'm going to have a heart attack over this child." This child had come out of a methamphetamine home that was cooking and selling. They'd seen everything. I mean, whether it's raw sex or whatever, these children have been through it. They are difficult to handle. The Schuberts had had them, and we're not trying this case for custody. I'm just trying to lay out the sequence. The Schuberts had had them for foster parents, then became adoptive parents, and then after three respite requests, the department pulled them out. That was the reason that they were taken from the home. Not gross misdoing on the part of the Schuberts. They sought everything they could to do in terms of parenting skills, in terms of learning to get the children back, but they have not said that. And that's why I think a simple hearing between an arbitration officer would take a lot of the emotion out of it and make it a lot more fair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if it was just respite care, were there other specific types of assistance that were guaranteed you by the state upon adoption of your children?
Well, they guaranteed us all the psychological and physical help that the children would need, except that in the Tyler's psychological evaluation, the bottom line for him was Tyler was not a danger to himself, but was a danger to others, and they didn't want to act on that.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Yes, you may.
So, did you receive any, besides I don't know if you ever did receive any respite care, but did you receive any other kind of assistance that was initially offered to you or promised to you?
Not adequate for Tyler's case. I mean, he didn't need play therapy when we saw that report. I mean, this child needs psychological help, big time. And I brought that to everybody's attention. And we got a real spitting match with DHS over that. And they got, I think, really got tired of hearing us tell them that, you know, what you're doing isn't going to help this little boy. He needs serious help, more than what you're doing here, because what you're doing isn't changing things. Because every time he went to school, he got suspended six times for aggravated, I mean, he put child in the hospital.
And final question.
Yes, you may.
And did you try and get any kind of services, or did you get services for your children, like through your insurance, or
we tried to get them into another program, through because the state has different organizations that they deal with. Well, we tried to get him into a different one, and we were denied.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee. Let me make a couple of my comments here, and I know that we have a couple of representatives from state will testify right after you folks, but I kind of want to give you my quick view of the bill because I think it needs some major changes in order to accomplish what you want. In other words, I assume it only is going to apply what we call dependency proceedings, but I don't know that from when I read the bill. And secondly, the cost of arbitration is not met in the bill. I don't know who would bear that or where it would come from or how it would be paid for. I think third is a question I have is what the court system's reaction to this would be. In other words, if it's binding arbitration, does the judge have to accept that as a part of the judgment in the case? And that's not spelled out. I assume that that's what would happen. But I'm just afraid that unless you fill in some of these blanks, the bill might be difficult to administer. And, of course, if the state thinks it's going to be difficult to administer, it may not get administered at all. Okay. So I'm trying to make it a little bit better. And I will be happy to work with Representative Anderson to connect these dots.
Mr. Okay. Chairman, if I may?
Yes.
The one thing that may really expedite this bill is the fact that there's basic law set down as to time restraints of how often they're supposed to have a hearing, 30, 60, and a 90-day hearing. Our 90-day hearing didn't happen until well over a year later.
And that was
so, I mean, if we're into arbitration, you're going to bypass all that court calendar clog.
No, I think we understand the efficiency of arbitration. It just has to fit this particular mold. That's the only thing I'm worried about right now. I do agree with my experience of juvenile courts. It's just a black hole sometimes, and you just never get out. You just never get out of the black hole. Okay, other questions, comments, suggestions from the committee? Hearing none, we thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Witnesses to,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Two more witnesses, Timothy Travis and Una Swanson. Please come forward.
Good morning. I'm Timothy Travis from the Oregon Judicial Department. I don't know this case. Never heard of these people, so I don't know the particulars. I know I've heard one side of a very compelling story this morning. But I want you to ask yourself as you consider this story, would arbitration have solved this problem? There is absolutely no doubt that the child abuse and neglect system is at times a costly system, as all legal systems are. We have case flow management projects right now going on in the Oregon Judicial Department to try to speed things up and to make things more efficient. We have pro se litigant projects that we're working on to help people who do not have attorneys or choose not to have attorneys navigate the waters of the system. And there is absolutely no doubt that there is a stunning need for more post-adoptive services to the men and women of Oregon who are willing to adopt the children who come out of our system. The children who come out of the child abuse and neglect system and are put up for adoption are damaged children, by and large. They are not the cute, pink, cuddly little babies that you see in the Gerber commercials. And these people need far more support than the citizens of Oregon, the taxpayers of Oregon, have yet seen themselves able to provide. Will arbitration solve this problem? Arbitration does not obviate the need for a lawyer. Arbitration is a legal proceeding in which one side lays out their legal case and the other side lays out their legal case, and the arbiter makes a decision. Ask yourself a question. In this case that you've heard about this morning, if the arbiter had decided in favor of the agency and not in favor of the Schuberts, would the Schuberts have shrugged their shoulders and walked away from their children? No, they wouldn't have. None of us would. The Schuberts would have appealed that decision to the court, and the decision would have been made in the court where it's being made now. Could the court do a better job? We can always do a better job. We have a 20...
Mr. Okay. Chairman, if I may?
Yes.
The one thing that may really expedite this bill is the fact that there's basic laws set down as to time restraints of how often they're supposed to have a hearing, 30, a 60, and a 90-day hearing. Our 90-day hearing didn't happen until well over a year later.
And that was
so, I mean, if we're in arbitration, you're going to bypass all that court calendar clog.
No, I think we understand the efficiency of arbitration. It has to fit this particular mold. That's the only thing I'm worried about right now. I do agree with my experience with juvenile courts. It's just a black hole sometimes, and you just never get out. You just never get out of the black hole. Okay, other questions, comments, suggestions from the committee? Hearing none, we thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Witnesses to,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Two more witnesses, Timothy Travis and Una Swanson. Please come forward.
Good morning. I'm Timothy Travis from the Oregon Judicial Department. I don't know this case. Never heard of these people, so I don't know the particulars. I know I've heard one side of a very compelling story this morning, but I want you to ask yourself as you consider this story, would arbitration have solved this problem? There is absolutely no doubt that the child abuse and neglect system is at times a costly system, as all legal systems are. We have case flow management projects right now going on in the Oregon Judicial Department to try to speed things up and to make things more efficient. We have pro se litigant projects that we're working on to help people who do not have attorneys or choose not to have attorneys navigate the waters of the system. And there is absolutely no doubt that there is a stunning need for more post-adoptive services to the men and women of Oregon who are willing to adopt the children who come out of our system. The children who come out of the child abuse and neglect system and are put up for adoption are damaged children, by and large. They are not the cute, pink, cuddly little babies that you see in the Gerber commercials. And these people need far more support than the citizens of Oregon, the taxpayers of Oregon, have yet seen themselves able to provide. Will arbitration solve this problem? Arbitration does not obviate the need for a lawyer. Arbitration is a legal proceeding in which one side lays out their legal case and the other side lays out their legal case, and the arbiter makes a decision. Ask yourself a question. In this case that you've heard about this morning, if the arbiter had decided in favor of the agency and not in favor of the Schuberts, would the Schuberts have shrugged their shoulders and walked away from their children? No, they wouldn't have. None of us would. The Schuberts would have appealed that decision to the court, and the decision would have been made in the court where it's being made now. Could the court do a better job? We can always do a better job. We have a $24 million hole in our budget right now. And if that hole was filled, we could do a lot better job of solving some of these problems. So arbitration, as the good representative said, arbitration probably can be appealed to the court. It probably, and the question, yes, of course, an arbiter's findings can be made the fact-finding in a case. Of course they can. But ask yourself the question, what are you buying by creating another layer of decision-making. We live in child abuse and neglect cases in a system which is bound by federal law. There are things we have to do by federal law in order to qualify for the money that supports the children in foster care in Oregon. And that's I understand, around $100 million a year. We cannot forego this federal money. Specific findings have to be made by a judge, by federal law. And there is congressional legislative history that says a judge has to make those findings. And if those findings are not made, then the federal money that supports that kid in foster care is closed off under Title 4E of the Social Security Act. So even if an arbiter makes a decision, that decision has to be ratified in some way and incorporated into a judicial order so that when the people from the federal government come, which they do, and rifle through our files to give us helpful suggestions about how we might do our job better, they need to see certain findings in the court order. And if they don't see those findings during an audit, we have problems. Okay. I couldn't help, by the way, as I was listening to the Schubert's case, I once represented abused and neglected children in juvenile court. I've represented kids in delinquency action and dependency action. I've been on both sides of termination cases. I've represented kids on every crime from stealing bicycles to aggravated murder. I made $31,000 a year when I was doing that. I think that's stretching high-priced lawyer. Okay, just my own little editorial comment. What court hearings would be covered by this arbitration? All court hearings, including termination of parental rights? That's a serious problem. What's at the basis of this is the phrase separation of powers. This bill takes a judicial function and assigns it to the executive branch of government. You could as easily write a bill that would take the judicial function of child abuse and neglect cases and give it to you. That's the magnitude of change that you're talking about. You're talking about taking a system where the branch of government that is supposed to be executing the laws is now going to interpret what the laws mean in specific cases. I don't think you want that responsibility. I don't even think that the executive branch of government necessarily wants that responsibility. I know you have heard some things this morning about the court in this hearing and in the first hearing you had this morning that I can't explain or justify because I don't know the circumstances and the particulars of that first bill that you heard this morning, the one about attorney fees and state agencies. But I do know this, that courts are supposed to be the part of government that protects citizens' rights. That's hard to say that after that testimony we heard this morning. But that's the way this system is supposed to work. We are supposed to be the ones in the court that protect citizens' rights. And what you have in a child abuse and neglect case is you have a state agency that's coming into people's homes and taking their children away. And people have constitutional rights under the Fourth Amendment, the right to consanguinity. They have rights, constitutional rights. And now this bill seeks to put into the hands of the people who come into the home and take the children the duty of protecting the rights of the people whose children they're taking. The way to solve shortcomings in the judicial system is not to strip away its duties and give them to the other branches of government. The way to do that is to help the judicial department do the job that it's supposed to do. Arbitration won't solve this problem. I'll tell you what will go a long way towards solving this problem, and that's mediation. Mediation is an entirely different process than arbitration. We have a Chief Justice's maintenance level budget in this session, but we also have a policy package in this session. And that policy package is for a relatively small amount of money, under $500,000. And what that project would do is it would save a mediation program in juvenile cases, child abuse and neglect cases, that's been running for about 4 years off of my little tiny federal grant. And that project has been working in four counties, and it has stellar reviews from parents, from everybody involved. And what happens is in these cases that the parents and the state get together in front of a specially trained mediator, and they come to an agreement about their case, and then they take that agreement into the judge, who ratifies it and makes it a part of the judgment in that case. That's the solution to this kind of problem, insofar as there is a solution. But there's always going to be cases where there is no solution, where all you can do is go into court. Because in the end, if people don't agree, somebody has to make a decision. And as I said earlier, if the arbiter's decision had gone against the Schuberts, would they have shrugged their shoulders and walked away from their children? I wouldn't, and you wouldn't. It's the nature of what's going on here. So there's a lot of things that I could say about this bill. It might be hard to believe, after all I've said, that there are still a lot more things that I could say about this bill, but there are a lot more things I could say about this bill. But I will let it go at that. But let me emphasize, after this legislature fills the $24 million hole in our budget and gives us the Chief Justice's maintenance budget, consider that policy package. For under $500,000, we could put a mediation program in juvenile court cases in every county in Oregon. And we could take a lot of the fussing and fighting out of this system, and we would do a great service to the children of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Travis. Ms. Swanson?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Una Swanson, and I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to testify about House Bill 3078. Some of the points that I have to make today have already been made, but I'll just go through them briefly. It's my understanding that the intent of this bill is to be supportive of parents who don't qualify for court-appointed counsel, and we certainly agree with that concept, but we do have some concerns about the bill as it is written. DHS will need to determine, if this bill were to go into place, would need to determine if the federal government, if voluntary arbitration is an adequate alternative to a judicial proceeding and other administrative reviews in terms of federal expectations for Title IV-E funding. When we take a child into protective custody, we go into court within 24 hours, and the first decision is whether or not we've made reasonable efforts to prevent the removal of that child, and that finding then becomes contingent for us to receive the 4E funding. So DHS has concerns that this process may create a parallel process to the ongoing judicial proceeding, and I think Mr. Travis has spoken to that. DHS is not certain how this process will be used in situations where there is a need for an emergency placement and a subsequent judicial hearing. We need to have that hearing within 24 judicial hours, and are not quite certain how that would work in terms of setting up arbitration. DHS is not certain if anyone will have the right to appeal this process. We've certainly heard some comments this morning that they would be able to, but it isn't clear in the way the bill is written today. House Bill 3078 directs that the department will adopt rules necessary to implement the arbitration process. It appears inappropriate for the department to develop rules that would replace the oversight of the judicial system, and I believe we've heard others talk about that today. House Bill 3078 is unclear how an arbitration process will reduce the costs or time it takes to resolve the dependency cases. It appears to be an addition to an existing judicial process. Information from dependency court hearings is currently used in subsequent dependency court hearings, civil cases, criminal proceedings, and House Bill 3078 prohibits the use of any information disclosed or findings made in other legal proceedings. I'd just like to remind the committee that the Department of Human Services already uses a number of models to seek consensus, such as mediation and family decision meetings, and the judicial system also uses settlement conferences and mediation in the same way. I appreciate this opportunity to testify, and I'm available for any questions you might have.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Questions from the committee? I just have one, perhaps to Ms. Swanson, since it's in your written testimony.
about current dispute resolution and consensus building models, including mediation and family decision meetings. I acknowledge that you do have those systems set up. How well utilized are they, and are they a process provided for in the Oregon administrative rules, or something that's just totally discretionary with the department?
Actually, they're both in. We have some expectations for meetings to be held beginning at the point of removal in our Oregon administrative rules. And then we have the Oregon family decision meeting, which is a statutory expectation in which a meeting will be held between 30 and 60 days if a child has been removed from their home. And the purpose of that meeting is to determine both what efforts we can make to reunify that child with their families and what other alternative placements might be available, what services should be available to the family.
Fine, thank you. Further questions, Representative Garrard?
Yes, for either representative to respond. If when you were doing an initial investigation you came across a suspected criminal activity, would this arbitration supersede the normal course as it stands now, or would the parties be able to go to arbitration even though there may have been something criminal involved?
I'll go ahead and Representative Ackerman and Representative Gerard, if we're involved with a family on a dependency matter, it's not unusual at all for there to be a criminal process going on as well. And we work collaboratively with law enforcement. First of all, we don't want any activity we take beyond the safety and protection of children to interfere with the criminal process. But we are working through the juvenile court process focused on what the safety needs are for the children and the placement needs are for those children. And the criminal process is moving alongside that. I'm not sure if that answers your question. I don't know how arbitration would work in this situation.
Follow?
Yes.
That was basically, could arbitration trump an incident of suspected criminal activity?
Representative Gerard, this is as Ms. Swanson has said, this is a very common situation, not every case, but it's common enough. And a number of things happen depending on the seriousness of the criminal behavior involved. Criminal behavior can stop a dependency case dead in its tracks if it's serious enough. For example, if it's a Measure 11 crime, there is just no way. It would be unusual that we could go forward on the dependency case in terms of establishing jurisdiction, simply because the defendant is not going to be willing to incriminate him or herself or run that risk in a juvenile court proceeding. If there's enough external evidence, you might go ahead and do it, but it would be rare. There is an inherent conflict between criminal prosecution and child abuse and neglect proceedings. But there would be no way that somebody would go into an arbitration and then walk out of the arbitration and say, well, sorry, you can't try me on the crime now because we've done this arbitration on the child abuse side.
Okay,
it might work the other way. If someone were convicted of a crime that were, say, physical abuse of the child, and it was like second-degree assault, if someone were convicted of that crime, we could take that finding into juvenile court and use that as the basis for establishing jurisdiction in regard to that person. But it can't work the other way because of the different standards of proof.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? All right. I don't have anyone else signed up on this bill. Is there anyone that wishes to testify? I'm going to conclude the public hearing on House Bill 3078 with just a couple of remarks. I would ask that before amendments are submitted on the bill that Representative Anderson consult particularly with Ms. Swanson about the pre-existing mediation and family decision and settlement conference processes that may be available to people within the juvenile court system. And I'd be happy to sit in on that meeting. It may be that the solution is already there, but it's not well utilized, well recognized, and I'd like to exhaust that opportunity before we try to fix the bill, which is going to, I think, have some structural problems with it. So those are my comments. I'll offer my services to that extent to see if we can help this situation along. All right. I think we now have a quorum, and I'll proceed with a work session on House Bill 2545 and open that work session. Council?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2545 was originally heard before this committee on March 2nd. This bill is relating to public records requests. Basically, the bill restricted what public bodies could charge for public records, specifically restricting any charge for attorney's fees and some labor costs. There are -2 amendments which have been made available to you that, I guess, make those restrictions less so. They spell out what attorney's fees can be charged and what attorney's fees cannot be charged for these public records requests. And it's my understanding that these were taken from the Attorney General's manual that most agencies use anyway.
Thank you, Council. This was my bill as chief sponsor, and the original bill was to ban the assessment of legal fees on the public information requests. It became apparent that there are specialized situations where the imposition of legal fees may be necessary. And when, so we set up a work group, talked to persons representing the court system, legal work in cities and special taxing districts, the newspaper publishers through Mr. Gallagher and others. And what we found is that the Attorney General and his model rules of procedure have already covered this topic, and that is what the -2 amendments are. It comes from their manual. We thought this was the best we could do in terms of the time limits we have, what we're trying to address. And it does become a little more objective as to when they can incur legal fees in public information requests. And also in subsection C requires the public body to inform the requester of public records of the estimated legal and the labor costs before the documents are produced. We had some situations come up where people would request documents and then get blindsided by costs which they did not think either were warranted or were anticipated. So I think this would have a couple of effects. One, it's probably just good government to let the people know what this is going to cost before the records are produced. And it would have the idea of weeding out the number of frivolous or over burdensome requests. We heard particularly from Brad Swank of the Judicial Department that many people that are incarcerated will file very, very, very broad requests. And if you could let them know what that's going to cost, then probably they would narrow the request and make the disclosure more adequate. So anyway, that's the history behind this, and I think it's a significant step forward in the public records issues. And with that, I will move that the -2 amendments be incorporated within the main bill. Is there any objection? Hearing none, the -2 amendments are incorporated within the main bill. The chair will move that House Bill 2545 as amended be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion from the committee? I've already made my argument.
Sure,
Representative Worth?
I just wanted to make sure, like, the Oregon cities, have they signed off on this thing?
The League of Oregon Cities contacted me this morning and said they had some additional suggestions. I do not believe they were at the work group meetings. I told their representative that it was my intent to go through with the bill this morning, forward it to the full committee. We will take a look at their suggestions at that point. If not, it's going to have to be solved on the Senate side. Further discussion from the committee? Hearing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores excused. Is that correct?
Yes, she is.
Thank you. Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 2545 is forwarded to the full committee as amended with a due pass recommendation. I will be the carrier. I will now close the work session on House Bill 2545. Further business of the committee? We're adjourned.